Off the ball.
Jamie caught Frank with quite a bad challenge and the physio's patching him up, and Les Seeley, his turn turned to Frank. He went, Frank, get back on and do him good and proper. He said he took a liberty there. He said, make sure you leave it on him good and proper. And I'm stood there, I'm thinking, oh, hang on. He's talking about him doing my... This ain't right, you know?
Off the ball.
Weeknights from 7 and weekends from 1.
This is OTB Sports Radio. Live 24-7 on the OTB Sports app. The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.
The Off the Ball podcast on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
Fall to Dash, the final hour of our Nollaig na Mann programme, which is brought to you in association with Lidl. More for you in 2021 for Lidl's great range of healthy recipes and products to kickstart the new year. Check out lidl.ie/healthy. So as I said, we're on to our final hour now, and this is our special panel to wrap up the day. It's our 20 by 21 panel, Next Steps for Women's Sport. And I'm delighted to say I'm joined by three special guests via Skype. That's Dr. Katie Liston. She is, of course, a lecturer in sociology and sport, broadcaster Gráinne McIlwain, and journalist, and obviously much more importantly, from Cork, Joanne O'Riordan. Gur míle maith, ladies. Thank you for joining us.
Gur míle maith, Tessa.
Well, first things first, I think I should let you know, normally if you're in studio, you could sit here and point and laugh at me. I've got melted Kinder Bueno all over me. This is what happens when I'm sitting in a studio by myself and chocolate bars and vending machines nearby. They got to get me out onto a sideline soon. Joanne, I'll start with you. I suppose the big question, it's very hard to quantify these things, but did 20 by 20, did it achieve what it set out?
That's a nice hard one to get me.
That's
in
why
there,
I went
Mara.
To you first.
Look, I think in terms of actually like the, when they rolled out the statistics and how, you know, they increased the participation and the media rates and coverage and different things like that, they probably did succeed. I think still we're still really lagging behind. You know, I know some newspapers, some radio stations, they still, you know, it's still in the low 10, it's below 10% for a lot of them. So I think really now they've achieved in terms of getting us aware that the inequalities exist. So I think now it's up to us across the board, no matter who we are, as fans, media outlets, clubs, different things like that, just to get our percentages up and do it on our own end.
Dr. Katie Liston, obviously you would be able to read these statistics very, very quickly and look into them and tell us, I suppose, have we improved, or, you know, is it a dead cat bounce? It only had to go one way, or am I just being very, very cynical about the whole thing?
I don't know that you're doing yourself an injustice, Mara Trasser, if you're saying you're being cynical, because I think it's important to try to take a balanced approach to this, particularly when we're thinking about the future, because, I mean, the next decade's going to be probably very interesting and hopefully exciting for women's sports, not least because we now have, on the island of Ireland, a formal state policy around women in sport. That didn't exist up to now. And for some of us, that's quite hard to believe. For others, they might not even be aware of that because, you know, you would assume there was a coherent statewide strategy in place when you look at the success, arguably mainly driven by the organizations themselves in women's sports. So that's going to be very exciting. And there are targets in place that are measurable. There are programs that are going to be funded. And reviews will take place, which drives progress in an evidence-based, I guess, direction. And that's really important. And we don't have to be cynical about that. I guess what we're saying is we need to see evidence of a transfer of the momentum that Joanne has described into meaningful change. And I was very impressed by the 20 by 20 campaign. I think that the timing perhaps might have been better with some of the Sport Ireland initiatives, but I mean, that's in the past and we do need to build on the momentum as Joanne has said. But at the same time, visibility isn't the panacea. It's important, of course, the more you see it, the more you can be it. But I'd hope that if you've saved the best till last, Mara Trasser, and hopefully you have, this is the last of the Nollaig na Mann panel today, that you know, a lot of our listeners and the supporters of women's sport are very astute and know that visibility is probably just the tip of the iceberg, because underneath what you have are a whole set of values, attitudes and beliefs about how sport is, or if we think about the future, how sport should be. So my focus is on things like the institutional discourses and the organizations themselves that are now going to be charged with our own tax money, with state funded money, to make positive change in the direction of what we call gender equality. And I suppose I've been guilty at times of being a bit frustrated at the pace of change, and that's because I have a background in women's sports. And more than that, I guess we need to recognize the wonderful developments that were really made by the pathbreakers. If you think about the history of women's sports, in many ways it's still in its relative infancy, especially when you compare that to modern sport as a whole. You think about the big organizations, the big three as they're known on the island of Ireland. I mean, the women's codified versions of those sports, 1970s and rugby 1991. So we're still almost only coming to the cusp of celebrating 50 years. And there have been a lot of positive developments, but you don't need to be a cynic, I think, to want to ask some challenging questions about how that will translate and how that momentum will be built on over the next decade.
Yeah, I suppose where I'm coming from, Gráinne, is that this is all wonderful, don't get me wrong. And I suppose I'm ready to move on the conversation from, look how many people were at the ladies' football final. I just feel like we've gone well beyond that now. Let's look at where people are showing up at the other games. And Gráinne, you're in the good position in that you've been the face of ladies' football on TG Cahir for years now at this stage. You know it inside out. You've been to every ground in the country. You've seen it when there's one person showing up and 50,000 showing up. So over the years, how have you seen it evolve? Not just from supporters' point of view, but just the level of elitism when it comes to the actual sport.
Yeah, I suppose I'll answer two questions just to go back to the 20 by 20. First of all, Mara Trasa, and I actually was at that launch in 2018, as I'm sure a lot of you were as well. And the one thing that really I found very poignant at that launch was the video of the young girls who were asked, who are your sporting models or who are your role models? And they were like, and it was all men. Every single one of them were men. And it really struck me because I have a daughter who was a similar age. She's going to be 9 actually tomorrow. So I was thinking, my gosh, that's actually her in a few years' time if we don't do something something about this. Because like that with ladies football, I've been involved in seeing some brilliant, brilliant role models and how successful they are. But they were not getting any recognition for that. And I think with what the 20 by 20 has done is it's been a brilliant awareness and marketing campaign. And when you look at one of the key aims of the campaign was to make women's sport a bigger part of Irish culture by making it more visible. Now, it's done that when they did research in 20 by 20 commissioned research to show this, like 80% of the public said, yeah, they were more aware of it, rising to 84% of men. So, again, I think we can all agree on that level. And as Katie and Joanne have said, there's obviously still a lot more to do. But in terms of women's football, I remember I started presenting it in 2008 on TG Cahir. And I actually, when you said you were doing that, you kind of would get a silence or a bit of a, all right, it's not the men's code, you know? And I was like, no, it's not. It's the women's game, you know, and I 100% like that. But from the start, I loved it because when we talk about values and when we talk about that connection, we always had that as broadcasters with the LGFA because the players were so giving off their time. And it was just brilliant to actually be fit to highlight and showcase the brilliant talents that they've had. And I think a lot of the criticisms that might have started off early on was, well, the product's not very good. You know, they're not really as talented as men. And that argument always drove me crazy because I was like, well, we're not watching men playing. We're watching women play. Women and men are totally different from each other. But the product, the standard, everything has changed. And I think a big thing, which we're probably going to touch on, is investment. Investment makes a massive difference as well. And that visibility. When you have investment and visibility, you get sponsors wanting to get involved. You get that recognition. And one of the big changing moments for me for the 20 by 20, and I know it was outside of it, but was the Women's Soccer World Cup last year when you actually saw, you saw the USA, you saw these massive teams, the French team, the Holland, and they were recognised and we got to watch them. And there was a massive buy-in by supporters on it, on media, and it was visible. And you could actually see afterwards, like even my own kids were home, you know, Megan Rapinoe was a household name. Every time they'd go on, oh, there's Megan Rapinoe. And then you see coming on after that when you actually see Tobin Heath and Christian Best coming to play for Manchester United. And their jerseys actually outsell the men's jerseys last summer. So I think it's actually, it's visibility, it's sponsorship, it's actually giving women that platform to excel and to see them. We all know what they've done. I've been there from very early days of 2008. And even though TG Cahir have been broadcasting it 20 years this year. But it's great to see that it's moving in the right direction. to say that we want to see more, 100%, like you see the massive crowds at the All-Ireland Finals Day. You don't see those crowds at other games during the year. And the last 2019, and we all know it's been very, very difficult in terms of COVID-19 for moving sports on. But it's been a definitely, for the 2020, it's been a very successful campaign, but we can see a lot more to be done.
I have to say, Gráinne, hosatú cántin sin, and because I think this is the first time I've actually ever spoken English to you, I lost the first 10 seconds of what you said to that Bronner, but take him Gaffer then out there too. It just felt really unnatural there for a second. But somebody with things do come very naturally to her is Katie Liston. Obviously, you know this stuff inside out, Katie. So the big question now is, we have the government buy-in, like you said, we have the kind of the state buy-in that this has to be done. Most sound people understand now this needs to be done, and it is being done. But how do we quantify that? How do we, aside from, you know, people clicking people as they come in through gates, how do we quantify increased perception, increased awareness and increased participation?
Yeah, I mean, the Sport Ireland have identified a number of pillars, Mary Trasser, around coaching, around leadership, around participation, as you say. And I think the Federation of Sports in Ireland were an important partner for 20 by 20 as well in terms of the media representation and tracking some of that over time. So there are ways of taking, you know, baseline measurements and looking at it moving forward. And as Gráinne said, unfortunately, COVID-19 has pretty much thrown a curveball across all aspects of our lives. But in the context of what we're speaking about, I mean, even the 20 by 20 directors themselves were at pains to acknowledge in the kind of the culmination event that they didn't have data for the full period of time. So what they were really focusing on was that first year, because they had a baseline measurement and then they had a reliable measurement 1 year into that. And obviously all sports figures were going to be skewed last year and arguably probably into the first 6 months of this year. But there are ways of tracking that going forward. I mean, anything that happens in women's sports in Ireland isn't going to be immune from global flows either. And that's in some ways a positive development, because the spurt that has occurred in women's lives more generally, particularly since the 1970s and 1980s, reflects that uplift in women's participation in all aspects of life. And Gráinne mentioned the likes of Megan Rapinoe and others. I mean, I think the fact that some of our top players are able to avail of those global sporting flows to be travelling initially, as it was in the case of soccer, to some of the scholarships in America, that was the first zone of prestige, really, in the women's game. It spawned, as it were, the first professional league, and America were very strategic throughout the 2000s in then using the hosting of the World Cup to, as it were, reinvest back into their sport. And that's why you see the American women's team being pretty much first or second in the world consistently now for the last 10 years or so. And our players are availing of that, many of them now moving to England, where we see a professional league there. I do have some concerns about that, however.
Why? I thought this would be good stuff.
Well, I mean, in the sense that women are able to avail of these growing opportunities, absolutely, Mary Tressa. But if you watch, I mean, I follow women's soccer fairly closely, given my background. I lived in England for 5 or 6 years, so I followed the women's game there. And there are some concerns about the ways in which the pre-WSL, the Women's Soccer League, the professional league in England, that fan base hasn't been, as it were, carried through in the context of what is the new professional league now, that's into his second or maybe third season, correct me if I'm wrong. And the connectivity that there was that drove women's football in England for many years, often, I have to say, with a turbulent relationship with the FA until about the mid-2000s, when there was a little bit of an organisational shift and the women's game was integrated more fully into what we know as the FA today. Not unlike what's happened here with the FAI and indeed here in Belfast with the IFA. But there can be uneven effects to that as well. And it's no surprise to me when I followed the English women's game in particular, that it's only certain clubs that are now at the cusp already and that will probably maintain that position. The clubs that were heavily invested in, firstly, in the men's game, now mostly owned by foreign owners, and in which the women's game is very much used now to capture this new niche market that's growing. But the target so far has been mainly young girls and their fathers. Now, that's a positive development, of course, but there are questions being raised then about how much, if you like, the pre-WSL fan base will be carried through in that. And they're the ones that essentially drove that game before it became professional.
Okay.
So I guess, you know, into the next 10 years and 20 years, it's more realistic, I suppose, to talk in decades. I do I do wonder about what's going to be sustainable for a continued growth in women's sports. If it's mainly about merchandising and capturing a niche market, because niche markets become saturated very quickly, as we know, in any environment, not least in sport. So, I mean, if we were to take that back a step and think about women's soccer here, there's quite a gap, and many of the coaches would talk about this, between the National League here and then the players that are mainly now selected in the international squad that were ever so unlucky, I think, not to make qualification this time round. And most of them are now, as it were, most of them, there are some exceptions, but they're plying their trade abroad because the standard of the game is higher. So how then do we translate this momentum and this focus to ensure, for instance, that the National League here is open to more investment, that the players get the support that they need, because for many years they were belittled, trivialized. I mean, Paul Rouse has spoken about this on Off the Ball, about the history of women's sports being in many ways a story of discrimination. So we're really in the infancy, I think, of modern sport on the island of Ireland, for women in particular. It would be a retrograde step for me, in my view, if any of the main sports were to collapse their women's sections. And sometimes that's what happens, these large organizations. So the WFA, the Women's Football Association in England, is pretty much integrated now into the FA. And this is why some of the questions are now being raised about the pre-professional fan base and the new fan base, as it were, and how sustainable it will be. It would be a retrograde step if the same happened in women's soccer here. And if rumors are true, and they're only rumors, there is a possibility that the women's football unit in the FAI will be collapsed. And that will be a retrograde step, I think, because it takes a core group of people to drive that forward, to have strategic investment, to be able to review and monitor it on a regular basis. And more than that, to identify where barriers haven't yet been broken and where, therefore, our attention really needs to be honed to do justice to those young girls that Grainne spoke about earlier, the girls that now see Megan Rapinoe, that see Áine O'Gorman, that see the Irish women's hockey team. But when those players have moved on, who comes next? Mm-hmm. And how can we ensure that that's translated without experiencing the same barriers? And I say that simply with respect, Mary Tressa, because when I watched the Irish women's soccer team, is it 2 or 3 years ago now, when they had that very public press conference, I was really frustrated and saddened for them, because they had to make that kind of statement. And I know, having played the game, how hard that was going to be. And more than that, some of their places on the team would have been threatened for speaking so publicly. But I was saddened because they might as well have been talking about my career 10 years previously. And I sat listening to them wondering, well, what exactly has changed, therefore, but what then needs to change? If we have a group of players, let's say generation by generation, hopefully not with quite the same story, but still talking about the same issues. So that's something for me that I am concerned about. And I don't want to be cynical about it. I just want to be honest. And hopefully the viewers and listeners will start to reflect on it a little bit more deeply, because we do have an exciting decade to come.
But you do, but that's a very valid point, though, what you're saying, because that resonates with me myself, is that the fact that, you know, the women had to make that very public press conference. If that had happened 20 years ago, I wouldn't have been surprised. And unfortunately, I have to say, if it happens in 10 years' time again, Joanne, I wouldn't be falling over with surprise either. Now, out of the four of us here, Joanne, you're the one closest to the crib. You're the youngest. Do you feel now that things are, in your viewpoint, women your age and girls coming up after you, that little bit, few years younger than you, is there a difference in perception at all? Or do you think, would they even be surprised if this happened in 10 years' time?
I can definitely say they wouldn't be surprised, because I think every single day that they wake up as a woman, they face discrimination. So I think, as from that point of view, no, they wouldn't be surprised. They wouldn't be surprised if they found out, you know, tomorrow morning, insert county team didn't have insert access to whatever thing that they needed to have. And I think that's literally because they know what it's like to wake up as a woman every single day. But I think there is a bit more of an awareness in terms of a sporting point of view that I see among the girls that are under 14, under 12 that exist here, where they're standing up and asking the question, why aren't I playing on the pitch? Why aren't I getting equal access to the dressing rooms every single day? And I think more and more questions that pop up, I think it's more I think it just encourages everyone else to kind of think outside the box more than anything else, you know. And I think that is super important. And I do agree with Katie and Grainne as well. Like, it's about encouraging a younger cohort to come together, demand access and demand inequality, I suppose, that they wouldn't necessarily kind of be used to. But I think I do agree that it is wrong to put that onus on them as well. We should be putting the onus on the organizations. We should be putting the onus on those who are involved currently in sports, I suppose, as my grandfather would call them, the suits from long ago, you know. And it's up to them and it's up to us now as the 24 plus, which I am at the minute, to demand this equal access that does need to happen. But Katie is right. I think, and I see that too in America with the NWSL and the WSL too, the fan base that exists, they're very much targeted towards the father and the daughter. There's no kind of desired conversation and contextualization for a fan like myself who's 24. You know, I know a good friend of mine, he's a diehard Arsenal fan and he gets a season ticket every single year, and it's only now recently he's getting a ticket to the women's games. So he rocks up and he can't believe that, one, the high-pitched screaming, as you said, you wouldn't want to be hungover. And secondly, he also can't believe that every single time they have to clap off the audience or the players on the pitch. He doesn't get that at all. He's like, if there's a bad game, let's call it a bad game. Like, I support Arsenal long enough, you know. I'm used to seeing bad games. But as he said, that kind of reluctance to equalize the game is still in existence at the minute.
Yeah, speaking of bad games, I suppose we should check in on the FA Cup while I'm here. And just updating my scores here. Obviously, Marine were playing today and we saw the hype that they were playing. And 68 minutes gone there. It is Spurs 5, Marine 0, I'm afraid. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more chats after this. Well, Tadash, just a reminder, our Nollag na Mann takeover today is brought to you in association with Lidl. More for you in 2021. See lidl.ie/healthy. And I'm joined here, just as a reminder, Dr. Katie Liston, Grainne McIlwain and Joanne O'Riordan. Grainne, a question for you. Obviously, women's sport, it doesn't matter with the greatest will in the world, like every sport in the world, it needs money, it needs funding, it needs advertising, it needs sponsorship. That's improved in recent years in Ireland. We'll use Ireland as an example. But it suddenly creates a whole new burden as well, doesn't it? Where you suddenly have to match a product with the money being pumped into it. And it can be a burden or it can be an opportunity, depending on how it's approached.
Yeah, I think it's an opportunity. I think we're at a stage now where we need to see more investment. We need to see more sponsorship being pumped into all different types of sports. And I mean, you can look at ladies football, which would be the one I'd be most familiar with. And you look at the work that Lidl and TG Cahir have done in promoting the sport, which has been fantastic. And I mean, I was just thinking about this during the week as well, when you see how ads and sponsors get things right. When you saw the Lidl ad campaign that they did and they used real footballers and they showed exactly what it's like when you play football on a mucky, mucky pitch. And it was brilliant. And then you contrast that with what happened with the Irish rugby team and the ladies and the jerseys and how they got it totally wrong by getting models in to model the jersey rather than actual female players to do that. So, I mean, sponsors have a huge impact on it. But I also think, and I'm going back to the Women's World Cup as well, and I think sponsors saw what we all saw was how good of a product it is and how many people actually wanted to get involved with it. And I think this goes back to something Katie says about the values. Like, you know, all companies and all sponsors, they want to be aligned with sport because of the values that they bring. And particularly, say, in GAA, it's great values that they have. And one of the things, I suppose, that strikes me now about society as a whole at the moment, like, we're very conscious and we're trying to look at issues of diversity and equality. And I think women's sports comes into that as well, where sponsors want to be involved in what they have in terms of they're inspiring, they're family oriented, they're socially responsive, inclusive. And that's key aspects of women's sport that sponsors want to get involved in. So the question I have for sponsors is to get involved. And it's such a difficult time this year because we're seeing sponsor events crashing. Like, the IRFU are now going to be under serious financial pressure this year, with the huge doubt now about the Six Nations, whether that's going to go on ahead. So they don't have the money to support the men's game. And you would really worry then for women's sport, where does that leave them? And I think the Six Nations for the women's rugby, they haven't even decided dates for that yet. So is that actually going to happen or not? You know, so there's a lot of events that are very up in the air because of COVID-19. So it's a really difficult time for sport. And I think it's very much trying to keep afloat. But I do think for getting involved. I think the players and athletes, everyone that's involved in playing sport at elite level now, they would welcome that opportunity to really showcase their talents. And what a sponsor can do is huge. But that comes into visibility. You need to be fit to see this on television. You need to be fit to recognize who these people are. We need to hear them speak. And I often think about role models as well. You know, kids see Ronaldo, they see Messi, they see them on television, but they also read about them in the paper. They also see them in magazines, in their local shops. They also see them everywhere online and on social media. So women need to get to that point as well. And I think sponsorship and visibility really catapults them into that league, which we've seen from those American footballers like Megan Rapinoe, as we've mentioned before.
Katie, is that a chicken and egg type thing? Because I do, just what Grainne was saying there rings very true to me. But do you need to be on TV, first of all, or streamed somewhere with a good audience before you get the sponsorship? Or do you need to get the sponsorship before you can afford to go on those kind of platforms? Or you can kind of see how women's sport and actually minority sport in general would fall between those two stools.
Yeah, it's a very difficult cycle to break, Maritrasa, and you're probably right. I mean, I would describe it as more a circular argument. I mean, we've seen mention of it, I think it was the Irish Times last year, that, you know, women need to, first of all, have success before that they can, you know, that success would be transmitted through either the mainstream media or the newer forms of media. But the difficulty we have, and that's why I placed the caveat on this before the break, you have to look at the stage of development of women's sports. And obviously it's uneven depending on the sports we're speaking about. When you compare that to men's sports, women's sports are underinvested in a sense. So on the one hand, it's very difficult for those players who are striving to achieve at the top level, perhaps not with the same level of investment, but at the same time, to be charged with a level of activism to try and transform the views of women's sports as well. That's very difficult, particularly for players who have to be focused on performance, as it were. I mean, Megan Rapinoe and others are arguably on a stronger platform, media-wise. They're also at later stages of their careers. And Rapinoe especially, I think, is a very good example of a social activist who is highly reflected, highly educated. And you can see she's very astute at using that platform to draw attention to some of the inequalities. And it's difficult. I mean, I remember, for instance, when I was working on my PhD, which is difficult in and of itself, having a conversation with my supervisor at the time to say, look, I have a chance to play in the Women's Champions League. This won't happen again. Can I consider taking a leave of absence for 4 to 6 months that would have allowed me to pretty much train as a full-time athlete? It had never been done before. And UCD at the time were the first club to bring in that level of training and to bring in scholarships. But more important than that, I knew in the background that we had to set up a committee to be able to raise all the money to travel, to be able to finance the players, to get kit, to find the sponsor that Grainne has described. And not just any old sponsor, as it were, Maritrasa, but sponsors that are serious about their corporate social responsibility to the values that Grainne has described. Because there are mixed messages sometimes when it comes to this idea of portraying women in the media. Because women's lives and then women's sports, they run alongside each other. And we have to ask difficult questions at times. Are we selling, quote unquote, women's sports because they're women or because this is high quality sport, or sometimes a mixture of both? And if those messages are very mixed, on the one hand, you can potentially underplay what is the sporting achievements and the desire for success and all of the things that comes with that, with the fact that this is a female who does X, Y, and Z in her life away from sport. And we don't see that much of a narrative around separating men from their sporting achievements as much as we do women. Again, it's not a criticism. It reflects the stage of development of women's sports.
Yeah, actually, that's a very good point, Joanne. I often feel sometimes that to get a woman on air, she needs to have won, at the very least, one All-Ireland medal or have more world titles than Katie Taylor. And also maybe be a barrister who saves lives in ICU at weekends for fun. It's like we hold women to a higher standard, which is of course why we're here, because we've reached the top.
I was going to say that's very complimentary, me coming on. I've just come off the back of saving a life or two myself. No, you're definitely right. And I think that is something that has to be addressed. And I think as well as that, in the media, we do need someone who we can push out there for someone to kind of grasp onto, someone who can do outrageous things, because I think the public respond to that a little bit more than what they would normally. I can only talk about myself personally, but even I know the commentary that I get whenever I do something is, it's great because she's got no limbs. And I'm like, well, the achievement would probably be great anyways, but that's cool. And I think it's the same. It is the same issue that does exist kind of among women in sports at the minute. And I think, you know, Katie's right. Do we take that narrative away from it and just focus on a high performance kind of point of view and critically analyze and assess the way we would a men's game? We probably can, but yet we probably can't, because it also has to be contextualized that women in sport has only been kind of at the forefront for the last few years. You know, you look at the FIFA World Cup, that's only under the FIFA banner for the last 20, kind of 30 years. So to put it on such a pedestal with the likes of, say, a Mo Salah, a Lionel Messi, or a Ronaldo, it would be kind of doing an injustice in a way, because it doesn't look at the background of what these girls had to come from in order to achieve such a high pinnacle of their career, which is to go to a World Cup. But I think you're right. I think some of the narrative and some of the inspiration kind of thing, that has to be stripped away as well. Like, they're athletes at the end of the day, and I think they want to be reflected upon and thought about as athletes.
And it's funny, Joanne, that you mentioned that, because there was an article today in the Mail on Sunday written by Philip Lanigan about Dublin's John Small and how he himself and his wife had a baby on the 2nd of January, which of course is great for a GAA underage career. But aside from that, it was just so normal. He was speaking about the bereavement. You know, he'd lost his father last year, spoke about the pride of his club in Ballymun and how proud he was of his newborn child. And I sometimes think with women, we expect them to be Wonder Woman who also keeps a great home and cooks a four-course meal. With John Small, we were just delighted that he told us about his baba.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely something that does need to be assessed. You know, I mean, you even think of, you know, the likes of Noelle Healy, I suppose, at the minute, being an anesthesiologist. Like, she's a picture perfect person for like what a woman should be, in terms of she's maintaining a relationship, she's maintaining her job, she's also maintaining a high football career. But that shouldn't be expected of everyone. Everyone is different. Everyone strives to achieve different things. And I don't think that picture perfect idea should be a proper reflection on the sport itself.
I also think, just to come in there, Maritras, as well, is that I think who is putting this pressure on everyone? I think we as women put a lot of pressure on ourselves to do everything because we've seen our mothers or maybe other female models in our lives doing all this. And we all know it's impossible. You cannot do absolutely everything. But some of the ad that I really liked and enjoyed is This Girl Can, where it's just real people actually getting back to exercise for the first time. So that's one thing that came out of the 20 by 20 research as well, is that women maybe not have gone back to playing team sports, but they've actually got involved with doing exercise again, which I think is brilliant, because that's what we all actually need to be doing every day for our health. And another thing as well, you know, in terms of role models, I think for young girls too, and their dads, and people are targeting dads and daughters, but also women, positive women role models in a young girl's life is hugely important as well. So for a lot of mothers, it's taking their kids to training. It's actually being involved, maybe going back doing training themselves, or just actually exercising, going out doing stuff, and actually and being involved, and that young girls say, well, mom did this, or mom's interested in this as well. Because I think that's important for as well, for young girls to see that women are involved in sport and really want to get involved in them, and that's the value they place on themselves as well, as seeing sport and exercise being as a huge part of their lives as well.
That's a very interesting point, actually. Katie, in your opinion, is it easier to be a girl who's interested in sport and playing sport today with the hopes of becoming an elite athlete in the future? Has the pathway been made in any way easier, or is the pressure exactly the same because of, at the end of the day, being a woman who's involved in sport, you can't kind of separate yourself completely from that vacuum of trying to do it all, if that makes sense?
That's a great question. And if you had hours, we could give it a go.
Well, you have 3 minutes.
Thanks. So I'm going to say hello to my niece, Anna, and Clara, and nephew, Sean, at home. But Anna in particular, because Anna has sprung into my mind in response to your question, Maritrasa. And last year and the year before, she said to me, Katie, I'm really annoyed about something. I said, what is it, Anna? It's West of Ireland, Gráinne. Mm-hmm. And she said, how come we have to wear skirts? And Anna is a big camogie player and hopefully will become a really good camogie player as she grows up. And I said, why? What's wrong? She said, well, I'd just like to have the choice. And I thought, that's a very fair point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Anna is fifth now, sixth class in school. So, I mean, the fact that she is able to reflect critically, is already playing that game, is thinking about what's important to her and how she'd like to wear shorts, because she sees it as a game and not for something to, you know, to wear a skirt. That's positive. And undoubtedly, if I you know, revert back to what I said at the beginning, Mara Trasa, the structures are better than certainly what they would have been 20 or 30 years ago, undoubtedly. But I'll pick up on something Negreanu said about women perhaps taking it for granted and doing so many things. The other aspect of this is that I think sometimes we're often more humble than is actually required. Mm-hmm. When you think about the kinds of achievements that many women have made in sport, oftentimes against more barriers than less, especially when you think historically about the pathbreakers of the 1970s and 80s, or the ones that did this behind the scenes with little or no support whatsoever. And it's now the platform that I played around the 2000s and that now my niece Anna is beginning to benefit from. I mean, that's a short story of 50 years. And that level of humility, I think, is also reflected in the fact that sometimes women ourselves, we're uncomfortable when it comes to gender quotas and discussing that, because there's this mismatch between the idea that we should be able to achieve based on merit, and therefore we shouldn't have any advantage or perceived advantage. But yet we're doing all of this in the background, mm-hmm. in an underdeveloped arena, and we know that women are just as qualified as men today. Now, that would have been very different maybe 30 or 40 years ago, but today we can say that with more confidence. But that there are institutional barriers which mean that doesn't translate into more equitable numbers of women on leadership boards, on executives, in the important decision-making processes. So that's why I think this decade is going to be exciting going forward, because when we can now see more women in these positions, there might well be some sea shifts in how leadership is presented, in the kinds of decisions that are going to be made going forward. And so the short answer, yes, it's certainly better than what it would have been previously. And more than that, I hope that Anna gets the choice going forward to wear whatever she wants when she's playing camogie.
And same if her name is Andrew, that Andrew can also wear whatever he wants if he's playing hurling or whatever. But Joanne, actually, that's actually a very good question or a bomb to throw at you now. Gender quotas, do you believe in them?
Look, I suppose I grew up in a family of five, and it's just me, my sister, and then three older brothers. So we're probably the last people you should ask about 50-50, because my parents just gave up after me. But no, I think overall, they might be needed in terms of trying to get a viewpoint across. And what I mean by that is you can't rely on, let's go back to white male privileged Andrew for a second, who's wearing shorts at a hurling match. Andrew doesn't know the issues of a skirt. Andrew doesn't know the issues of, you know, what happens if it's the time of the month and you have a leak on white shorts, you know, different things like that. So I think, yes, they are needed in terms of bringing a viewpoint and making sure that diverse viewpoint is heard. But I always kind of say to different companies that I kind of do talks with is, diversity inclusion is like, diversity is asking someone to a party, but inclusion means asking them to dance or request a song. And I think that's where we lack on big time. We're very quick to bring someone to the party, but we're not quick to ask them whether they want to dance or what song they want to listen to. And I think that's something we definitely need to work on in terms of whether we are capping with gender quotas and things like that. It's very easy to have someone who's the commissioner and she's a woman, but behind the scenes, she's dealing with 50 men who have no idea what's going on. And I think that's where we do need to make a bit of an impact in terms of getting more people on the boards and just sharing their viewpoints that, as we, you know, mentioned Andrew in his shorts playing hurling.
Joanne, well, we know if you're going to be ever singing, playing to a song or requesting a song, it'll be Mickey Joe Hart, We've Got the World Tonight. That'll be the song you'll be requesting. People saying, God, equality is terrible if this is what we're going to be dealing with. But Tanya, you've got a bit more, I suppose, life experience as well. You're a bit older than Joanne. You've seen more, I suppose, in one sense of things happening and quotas and non-quotas. Gender quotas, do you think we need them to just, at the very least, push things forward to get to that point?
I think in terms of, say, the campaign 20 by 20, it's putting pressure on organisations to do something. And I totally, I agree, I have this perceived sort of unease about gender quotas as well, and that if you're good enough for the job, you should get it. But unfortunately, we all know the world isn't like that. But I think there's a difference, and I think a lot of people have their head, like, gender quota, it's tokenism. It's grabbing the first woman that you see to actually be on the board and do something. And it doesn't work like that. Like, you know, it's actually, there are so many brilliant, brilliant women out there. And women are humble. We're not created pushing ourselves forward. Like, and a lot of us now, we're probably getting a little bit better than we would have been. But I think it forces organizations, it forces boards to go and find brilliant women. And you know what? If you don't know someone, go ask someone who does know some brilliant woman, you know? And that's what it's about. Like, I always think it's joking. If someone asked me to be on a nuclear scientist board and they go, okay, well, who will we get, Grani? We'll just get you because you're a woman. Like, I'd be terrible at it because I would know absolutely nothing about it and I just would be floundering. But if you ask me, do you know anyone that you could do? And I says, leave it with me and I'll come back with a number of names, because you can go and check someone and you're promoting and supporting other women who would be brilliant at that job. So I think I tentatively do agree. I think it's putting pressure on organizations, on boards, on people to look for those brilliant women and get those involved in them, in their organization. And I think in that respect, I definitely will be in favor of them because of that.
Yeah, I have to say I'd be a huge proponent of them after living enough now in this world to realize that my ideals when I was 22, 23, sure, if you're good enough, you'll get it. No. That ain't happening in this world. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about women. I feel like for everything from travellers, different backgrounds, all this kind of thing, we need to get better at actively recruiting these people and pulling them in. But like you said, only if they're good enough or giving them the tools to be good enough. Katie, what's your opinion?
I'm fairly clear on it. And I come from an evidence-based position, Mary Trasa, that gender quotas are very useful in time-bound periods. Mm. So, you know, you have to be able to clearly identify a strategy, but review it to see whether or not it's successful. I think they're also useful, and the evidence shows this, at early stages of development. And that's what I meant about, you know, contextualizing this in the relative infancy of women's sports, because the evidence in, for instance, the application of quotas in the academic world where I work full time and, you know, translated into sport is, as Grania said, it's not that you're taking an underqualified woman and elevating her above a highly qualified man. It's that, in fact, you're targeting a particularly qualified male or female, but you establish a minimum number of females so that everybody's standard lifts, not that you're elevating this woman above the man that should have got the role. And the evidence is very clear on that, that the organizational practice, not only in terms of diversity, but in terms of productivity, is therefore better. So I think there is a case to be made for considering it in certain sports over a period of time, but closely evaluating it to see how does it work? What are the barriers? Because, I mean, if we think about different sports, they will experience different challenges. There are different socioeconomic groupings, perhaps, that participate in some sports more than others. There will be some sports that Grania has mentioned or maybe alluding to that would have perhaps a greater network that would spread more widely compared to minority sports. So when we're thinking about maybe the organizations themselves that might well be charged with implementing a quota, or Sport Ireland call this a target, they therefore have to activate networks that previously might have not existed before. And that's where it becomes challenging for them. But it has been proven that when you do that, there are, because the world is a progressive place now, very qualified and able women who are more than capable of performing well at interview and therefore to be considered at their merit at that point. Not that they're going to be elevated above a more qualified male. Everybody gets a lift then because you're getting the best candidate for the right post.
And that's the chicken and egg thing again, Grania, isn't it? That, you know, if a woman is playing sport and she's confident, as we've seen with men, it gives you a certain confidence, it gives you a certain kudos when you're going in for that interview situation, be it in life, work, you know, sporting boards, organisations, that kind of thing. So again, it's the chicken and egg, whereas maybe if she was in the organisation from an early age and she was involved, she'd have more confidence as well going for those jobs.
Yeah, it possibly is. But, you know, I really love the idea of values. And this is something that I came to really late in life as well, like about what are your values and what do you want for yourself and from those that are around you as well. And I really think for young girls, like I was a secondary school teacher in a previous life. I was a history and Irish teacher. And, you know, just in girls and mixed schools. And I just see it's given them that confidence. And when you see young girls at like 13, 14, you can nearly see the change in them, like they're just that confidence starts to drop down and they're going through all sort of hormonal changes and everything happened at that time and just dealing with so many different things in school. And I always think, gosh, you know, it's trying to instill this new generation, this young generation, is like, you know, to be confident, to believe in yourself and that you can to anything, like, you know. And it's not being cocky, but it's having that confidence that a lot of men seem to have, that, you know, quite naturally, or else they just exude it anyhow. They show it, they put on that poker face, whereas I think maybe women tend not to do that a lot of the times. But it's actually having that confidence to believe in yourself, have those values that you were the right fit for this job, and go for it, you know. And I think it's so important as women to support that. And I would always say to any young women that are phoning me or talking to me or trying to get involved in media or anything that they're like, you know, just to give them as much help as you can. And it's like we talk about mentorship as well. And I think it's so important for people to find somebody that they can talk to and ask questions to as well. And that people are very generous of their time as well. So it's having that confidence. But I think, you know, the women that you're getting for jobs in different organizations and different state board, like, they're brilliant women, so highly qualified. I mean, you speak to so many women, they're so highly qualified. And sometimes it's about a belief and a confidence of just being able to do that job. And I think once they get in and they're shown that they are shown that generosity, or given the tools, more trust, as you mentioned there, to actually excel at this job, or to help them maybe path out ways that they wouldn't have had the experience to be involved in doing that, they excel at that job. And I think that's so important. So whether you are actually starting off in the organization or you're coming in, that actually you believe in yourself that you can do that, that you have the values to push yourself on and do that. And I think that's so important to teach girls all growing up, is that what values they have, how great they are in this world, and to shine. And I think every single person has the ability to shine in this world, and it's just finding what that passion is for you to do that.
Joanne, I love throwing the grenades at you. When do you think, just kind of to wrap up everything we've been talking about now, and all of you have made really good valid points and kind of things to be thinking about as we all head home tonight and during the week, at what stage do you think that we're going to be sitting down someday and saying, God, do you remember the days we used to have to go on the radio to talk about issues like this and pushing things forward? Do you think the time will come in your lifetime, in our lifetimes, where we won't be talking about this, or is it going to take longer?
I think it might potentially take longer, but I am optimistic, you know, for my nieces who are growing up in this day and age. Like, they want to play sport, you know, they want to be involved in whatever is kind of coming at them. And what I see in them, and even my younger cousins, you know, who are up as far as 18, 20, like, there's just such a brashness in them, and a bit of a confidence in them that I wish I kind of had, you know, when I was their age. So I think they're ready, you know, they're ready to go and maybe make a change. And I see that a long time. But as Grania said, it's about us kind of, who are a little bit above them, to help them, to lead them on, and to not maybe ruin them with maybe cynicism, or just maybe pure, I've just been beaten up too much in this world, you will be beaten up too, so there's no point. But I think, you know, it's just nice to see it, you know, in them. You know, it is just nice to see that they're willing to ask the questions, you know, they're willing to think about what's going on in the world. But I don't think it'll happen, you know, in the next maybe 10-20 years, you know. And I think I might be a bit cynical kind of thinking about that, but I think what we'll see happening is a generation who are growing up, who are willing to think it, question it, and who are willing to try and make a change about it. And I think that, for me, is one of the most important things we can leave the younger generation with, is to have these critical thinking skills, to have the ability to be able to stand up and say, I want to train on the same pitch as the men, or I want to have access to the dressing room, or I want to do this, or I want to do that. And I think if we do that, then I think we are doing a good job.
Joanne, I'm going to leave you the very last word in the programme. Good evening. Thank you very, very much, all three of you, for participating in this. Like I said, food for thought there from Dr. Katie Liston, Grania McAwain, August Joanne O'Riordan. We could have chatted for hours, but unfortunately the clock won't let us. And that's the end of our special Nollag na Mban, brought to you by Lidl for this year. Loads of work goes into this programme. Thanks to Nathan Murphy, Neil Tracy and Shane Hannan, who did all the production behind the scenes. Peter Malloy and Stephen McLone, who did all the sound. OTBAM is back from 7:30 tomorrow morning across the Off the Ball social channels, and we're back on FM tomorrow evening from 7 to 10 as usual. Talking History is up next. We'll chat to you tomorrow. Wash your hands, stay apart, wear a mask. For the love of God, stay at home. Please do this for your loved ones and those working in hospitals.
The Off the Ball podcast on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
The OTB Podcast Network, with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.